was the life of my delights and glory of my brightest days and comfort of my nights in darkest shades. If thou appear, my dawning is begun. Thou art my soul's bright morning star, and thou my rising sun. The opening heavens around me shine with beams of sacred bliss, while Jesus shows his heart is mine and whispers, I am his. My soul would leave this heavy clay at that transporting word, run up with joy the shining way to embrace my dearest Lord. Thank you. I think that's a very good song. Isn't that pretty? I think that's just about as just beautiful poetry. Sometimes when in the middle of winter, when the roads are getting hard and the money's getting scarce, I tell you, the tail end of going to college, the money that you'd set aside to do that on goes, but when I do graduate, I'm going to have a list this long of people to thank who've bought me tires and entire cars. pulling me through, and plus all the people who've bought tapes and everything that have that's, and Kay, bless her heart, the woman that recorded the tape with me, in order to help me get through school, any of the profit that's made from that, she hasn't taken her share, so it's all gone to get me through college, and I'm not the only one that she's helped get through school like that. Because she says she figures it's like passing on the favor that was done to her, because she's making, you know, a good salary now doing what she does. She's a nurse anesthetist, but she didn't have it when she went to college, and there was a benefactor. One of her college professors would sometimes, on her desk in the morning, in her book, there'd be a $20 bill, you know, helping her out like that. So Kay figures she's passing that on. Sometimes that's about all you can do for a good favor. You can't pay it back. You can only pass it on. So, I want Daddy to sing you one of the Primitive Baptist songs that I like to hear him sing a lot. Daddy, you want to use this book of mine?
I don't have mine.
Okay. Let me see. I'll find it if I can get my eyes focused. Whew. I about got it.
I hope I can get through the song. It is my father's favorite song. When I can read my title clear to mansions in the skies. I'll bid farewell to every fear and wipe my weeping eyes. Should earth against my soul engage, and fiery darts be hurled, then I can smile at Satan's rage and face a frowning world. Let cares like a wild deluge come, and storms of sorrow fall. May I but safely reach my home, my God, my heaven, my all. There shall I bathe my weary soul in seas of heavenly rest, and not a wave of trouble roll across my peaceful breast.
I tell you, there's something that's very sustaining about a song like that, not only because of the memory of my grandfather and hearing my dad sing that so many times, but the words of when the day has just been too much and it seems like things are coming in from all sides, and I even sometimes can just say the words, let cares like a wild deluge come and storms of sorrow fall. May I but safely reach my home, my God, my heaven, my all. It's just very sustaining, those kinds of things. I won't spend a lot of time telling you Gene Ritchie's background. I'll let you read about that on the covers of her albums, and from hearing her, you'll hear a lot about this at the 1 o'clock session today, which I hope all of you will be there for that. Just want you to meet the person that she is, and I will tell you that when I first met her, I came to Augusta about, I guess it was in 19, what year would that have been? It was the year Mike Seeger turned 50, I'm trying to figure it out. Long time ago. We're going to tell Mike, you said. It's been about 6 or 7 years ago, and I went to a songwriting class in that little blue house down there. You know, heavens, I've never written a song, and I still haven't. But I just wanted to be around these people, and it was Michael Klein was there, and Nimrod Workman that I was telling you about before. Nimrod was there, and Hazel Dickens, Gene Ritchie, and Craig Johnson. Well, Craig is a little bit younger. He's sitting over around this side of the room, and they would describe the circumstances of writing a particular song and then sing the song, not in a performance style, just sing the song. Well, by the time they had done that, when they got to poor Craig, it said, pass. It was just such a touching time. It was the best class I've ever had here. Didn't sing a note in the class all week. It was just wonderful. It just opened up so much to me. And that was when, you know, I had not sung. I mean, I sang when I was growing up, when I was small, but then I had not sung for 18 or 20 years. And that was when I started singing again, was from that class. Which is another way of saying the same thing I said the first day here. You'd be surprised how much you learn about singing from listening. And that was certainly what got me started, was listening all week to people like this. This is Jean Ritchie from Kentucky. Where in Kentucky were you born, so that it'll get it straightened out for them, your location?
I should have come earlier to the warm-up. I'm rusty this morning. I was born in Viper, Kentucky. It's a little village of about 350 people, I guess, and it's not grown much in those years. It's a post office and a few stores and people live up and down the hollers and that come down to get their mail. So it's a scattered community. It's not a town or anything. But it's 7 miles southeast of Hazard, if you want to know where it is.
That would be in eastern Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Southeastern.
Yep. So I imagine that, I haven't been exactly to Viper, but I imagine that area has changed a lot since you grew up there.
Oh, yes. You don't notice, if I go back a lot, I've got a log house there now, and so that I go from my other home back to Viper quite a bit, and I don't notice the changes as much until I really stop and think about it, but then it really is, it's changed, well, mainly because of radio and television and bringing the outside world in, and the roads, of course, the highways that have to be built so people can come in and haul out the coal on the railroad and the highways. That's changed things a lot.
Yeah, roads always do, don't they? Now, for those who don't know about your background, there were how many children born in your family?
Well, Mom was a Hall, and Abigail Hall, and she was born and raised in Viper. And my dad was a Furriner. He came from the next county. He was from Knott County, K-N-O-T-T, around Hindman over in there. And he and she married and lived in Knott County for a while, and then after their the ninth child was born, they moved back over to Perry. And I was number 14. I was the end of the family. Yeah.
How old was your mother when she died?
My mother lived to be 95.
Oh, goodness.
My father lived to be 89. I've got hopes.
Yes, definitely. Wow, that's great genes for long living there.
Yeah.
And I take it that did both of them do music?
Well, not really. Not we sang just to sort of accompany life, you know. We sang to work with Brooke by, and we sang to rock children by, and to churn by, and things like that. But we didn't consider ourselves singers, unless when we went to church. Of course, everybody sang together, and on the front porches at night we sang together, just the family, but just for enjoyment, not for any kind of entertainment for other people or anything like that. So it's just because there weren't too many. We could just see the next house, and people live kind of scattered and far apart. And once in a while, we'd have a play party or something like that, and get together for things like that.
What was a play party?
Play party was what you did. Instead of calling it dancing, you called it play party, so they'd let you do it.
play party. If it was all adults there, that you could still call it a play party?
Oh, yeah, everybody came, the old folks and the preachers and everybody. They all joined in, and everybody had a good time, played kissing games and everything.
We Because, you know, it's really funny. Trying to explain that to somebody that wasn't born in this culture, it seems like from what is said many times, this is a very repressive area that we must just spend all our time doing, just sitting like.
Oh, no. I did a little movie of my mother one time, where she's talking about that, and I said, "Well, how did they let you play kissing games and even play party dances?" And later on, people brought fiddles in and they would run sets. You know, they wouldn't call it square dancing or anything like that. You'd run sets, and she said, "Well, young people had to have something to do that was fun, or they'd get in trouble." She said, "You can't just make them go to church and work all the time." And so when she was young, they were allowed to do that. And she was a lot more broad-minded than a lot of the people around there. Some of the people were very strict in the church rules and everything, and they didn't want anyone to do anything that was fun. You know, that was sinful if it was fun. Mm-hmm. So these long-faced Christians, they call them, I guess. But my mother was never like that. She always believed that children and young people had to have a little bit of fun. And we had a lot of occasions where we could have fun.
And there were 14 in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived to be 95.
Mm-hmm. It's good for you, isn't it? I only have two. Yeah. She said it wasn't much trouble once you had the first five. You turn the little ones over to them and you go on about your business, you know. So
after the first five.
Well, I was having a family of 10, but I thought that was plenty.
Well, it was, I guess. It's not the style these days to have big families like that, but it was back then because you needed a lot of people around in those. The population was small, but as more people had big families like that, all the big game got wiped out. deer and all the wild game like that. And they have just little things now like rabbits and squirrels left, and so that it got harder and harder. And the land parcels you gave to your children got smaller and smaller, so people had to go to Detroit and to Cincinnati and places like that to get jobs and move out of the mountains. That's the mm-hmm. trouble with it.
Did you know, sometimes if you read too many child psychology books, they tell you that those middle children in there don't get much attention and they get, you know, they feel very left out. Do any of your brothers and sisters, do you think, did they get their share of attention?
I don't think that applies so much in a big family, because it maybe applies in a family of three. The middle child, you know, is always picked on, they say, or doesn't get as much attention as the young one and the little one. But in a big family like ours, you got sometimes more attention than you wanted from a lot of people. And a lot of people helped raise me, and anyone in the family that was older than I was felt that they were, he or she was... It was all right for them to tease me or rock me or love me or fuss or spank me. So I got spanked by everybody in the family, regular, because I was very obstreperous as a child.
did you and all of your brothers and sisters, did everyone go to much school? Was the school close by, or was it?
Yeah, well, the school was close for me. It was just maybe about a fifth of a mile or something down the road. And but some people had to walk to that same school. They had to walk 5 miles to get to it from up the heads of the hollers and things. So I was lucky in that way. Mm-hmm. No buses and no good roads. And it was just pretty primitive in those days. Mountains were very steep that came down. Well, like the mountains around here, except Kentucky. Closer. In that part of Kentucky, they're closer together, and there's not as many valleys, and so it's mostly mountains and just very narrow valleys and branches and little rivers, and everything is kind of closed in, so that there wasn't room for a lot of development there. Yeah.
But you did. you graduate from high school? Did you go to
school? Yes, I went to high school. Time I was born, my older sisters went to the settlement schools. They went to Hindman and Pine Mountain settlement schools, and I went to Viper High School. Mm-hmm. I was mad because I didn't get to go away to those fancy places, but I went to Viper High School, went on to Cumberland College in Williamsburg, Kentucky, and transferred to UK, University of Kentucky, and graduated from there. That's the extent of my education.
Yeah. Of the formal stuff on paper, anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Jean performs a lot of her music, but one of the real joys with Jean's music also, and I'm sure she would agree too, is hearing it performed by so many other people all over the world. People sing Jean Ritchie songs and record them, and sometimes with very interesting instrumentation. I've heard your music done with synthesizers, and because some of it, even though she herself is a very soft-spoken person, the songs carry a lot of weight, and they're definitely to be listened to, and sometimes with some due righteous indignation mm-hmm. in there about things that have happened to her area, to her people, and therefore to all of us. Well, and you do a little bit, you know, when you wrote, one of the ones that I always liked was Black Waters.
I'm going to do that tonight.
You are going to do that tonight?
Well, yeah, it's okay. Got slides to go with it, so
okay.
I want them to hear that then.
Well,
but
well,
I just,
do
yeah, I just, maybe I ought to start with what I remembered when I was little. It's little things. Sitting on Mama's knee, and or not Mama's or one of the other girls, or maybe sometimes even very rarely my father, and you dandle the baby up and down, and you say little things to him. We had a lot of little rhymes and jingles and things like that. Children kind of learn how to sing. The first they get the rhythm from the bouncing and the chants and so on, and then after a while they get the tunes, and the tunes start, and they start singing tunes to them. And so that, I think that older people, not really realizing it, had a good way of teaching children to sing. You first got to trot a little horsey, go downtown, watch out little girl, you fall down, you know, and you let them fall almost to the floor, but not quite, you know, and then getting that child shrieks and laughs, and then you say things to him like, I had a little pig and I fed him in a trough and he got so fat that his tail jumped off. I got me a hammer and I got me a nail and I made my piggy a homemade tail. And little after a while, a little child starts jumping up and down on the floor to that rhythm. And then you sing, prettiest little girl in the county, oh, prettiest little girl in the county, oh, prettiest little girl in the county, oh, Poppy and Mommy both says it's so. And what'll I do with the baby, oh, what'll I do with the baby, oh, what'll I do with the baby, oh, whoop her good and let her go. So things like that, and they learn these little simple tunes. And then, well, you listen to people. Mom sang old bloody ballads to me when she rocked me to sleep, too. I didn't really care. I couldn't understand what the song was about, really, but I loved the tune, the mournful tunes and everything, and just sort of made me go to sleep better. Or you'd hear people going up and down the road singing out on something. And singing in the old-fashioned style, they sound almost like the hymn tunes, you know, the old-fashioned way of singing love songs. It was just kind of slow and decorated. Come all you fair and tender ladies, take a warning how you court young men. They're like a bright star on a cloudy morning. First they'll appear and then And so that would keep you company as you walked along, and the hills would kind of throw back the echoes of it. You could sing it as loud as you wanted to. Nobody cared. And you could hear things like that for miles back up in the hollers, because there wasn't any airplanes back in those early days.
Or air conditioning units. Anything
but birds and the water going by, a branch going by singing, and occasionally somebody hollering to his mule or something like that. You wouldn't get a lot of interference. So when somebody sang out like that, you could hear them coming. You knew who it was, too, because you knew all the voices in the neighborhood. And, well, there comes Lee. He's coming down the branch now. He's going to go to the store for his old woman or something. You'd know exactly what was going on in the community by the sounds of what people were singing and, you know, making noises they were making. When you got together for parties, you had a rhythm, you had a different kind of thing. They had a little clap they did, which is very simple, but it was in because they had no instruments in the early days, they had to make their own accompaniment to the dances. So in the sets, people were standing around and waiting for their time to dance out, and they would be singing, making music. Or in one of the play parties, there was a lot of times when some couples were inactive, and the people that couldn't get into the set were scrouged in around the room, and they were all singing, clapping too, to help the dancers. And it just, you can't hear my foot stomp, but this was part of it. On the wood floors, you could hear it, and it would just go. Just like that, and that made the rhythm for the dancing. And the song was anything like, Charlie's knee, Charlie's sweet, Charlie, he's a dandy. Charlie, he's the very lad that stole my strap of candy. Over the river to feed my sheep, over the river, Charlie. Over the river to feed my sheep and to measure up my barley. But with a lot of people doing that, it made a good loud noise, and the floor made the stamps. And so that was how they danced. But then after a while, as I say, the fiddle came in and the banjo, and the people didn't have to sing and clap anymore, although they still did, just because they liked to. Church music was, yours was Primitive Baptist. Mm-hmm. Now, ours was Old Regular Baptist, and I think there's some kind of doctrinal difference there. I don't know what it is. I know the Old Regulars were very careful not to be called primitive or sometimes, what was the other one? There was Regular Baptist, and there was Old Regular Baptist, and there was Primitive Baptist.
Hard Shell Baptist.
All of them, to me, sounded like they're pretty much alike, but my mother would say, oh, no, they're very different. And the Old Regulars belonged to a what they called association, and the association was, I believe, in Catlettsburg. Once in a great while, people, representatives from the church, would go all the way to Catlettsburg, and that was a long trip in those days from Hazard, Kentucky. And their music was pretty much like the Primitive Baptist. Have you done Great Jehovah here yet? Let me just do you a verse of Great Jehovah the way my mother's church sang it.
You could do two verses. We didn't hear.
Mother's church was Mother's church because she joined when she was supposed to, and when she was 18, married at 17, had her first child, and joined the church. That was sort of what people did. And Dad was supposed to long go up and give the preacher his hand at the same time, but he was bashful. And so he didn't want to go out in the river and be baptized in front of all those people looking at just him, you know. So he put it off until he was 85. And finally joined. This is one of the songs that he saved. He told me one time that the Old Regulars used to just sing the low part, but one time he said that they had a habit of forgetting anything that was a little bit hard. You know, they would just sort of do the easy thing. But that wasn't always true. But on this particular song, it was. But he said one time he when he was a young boy, about 17, he said there was a man started following him around. And he was
a bad character that shot people and everything, and he was much older than my father. He was maybe in his 50s, but he used to follow Dad around and wanted to be friends with him. And my father said he'd run from him because he was so afraid of him. But after a while, he sort of got talking to him a little bit, and they called him Bad Tom Smith, and he was hung later. About a month before he was hung, he got up with my dad and he got him by the shoulders and said, "Them people in there are singing that song wrong." And so he told him how to sing the song right, and he could tell him the high part. He said, "Now that's the way it used to be." And then a month later they hung him, but my father remembered the song, and he always, and he went in.
I guess that would impress a person, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, he told me that, and I thought it was the strangest story, because I thought when I was young like that if a person went around shooting people and was bad, that there was no good in him. But then, look, he passed the song on, you know. There was some good in his heart somewhere. He was very worried that they were singing that song wrong. And so that this is why it got saved. It was because of Bad Tom Smith. Guide me, oh. I mean, they sung it slower than that and decorated it more. And of course, you know how many verses that song has. And so the singing started on Saturday, and they sang most of the day Saturday. And then on Sunday, they had singing and preaching. But people loved to sing so much together that they would gather on Saturday and sing all day. Mm. And then take up with the people at night and have chicken and dumplings and all, you know, all the good things, and then go back to church the next day for the real meeting. They had to come so far, some of them, that was the only way it made sense. And the preacher just got there once a month. It was a circuit riding church, so that was that. So that was the. Mm-hmm. Now they had some faster ones. Not many were faster. Some of them were not lined out. The chant that I did with the lines before I sang the lines was what the song leader would give out for the people to join in with.
We were tempted.
Well,
to join in.
You could have. You could have, but I didn't know whether you would or not. I didn't really expect you to, so don't feel bad. But you can sing along that way in that kind of singing. It sounds really hard to do, but if you just start a split second after somebody else that knows the tune does, you can kind of follow along with them, and as long as the tune rises and falls in the big parts, the big rises and falls at this more or less the same time, it's okay. And you can do your little decorations however way you want, on the ups and downs. Dad calls them the quivers and quavers. And Mama said, I said to ask her one time, why are all those old regular Baptist songs so sad?
and mournful. And she thought a few minutes, and she says, "Well, honey, they're not sad, they're reverent." And that made me think for a while. I was a little bitty thing. I thought they were sad. But I used to start, I remember all the babies used to start crying when they start that singing. And all the voices would rise and fall and decorate, and it was a, sort of an emotional thing. And but you, after a while, you notice that the babies are wailing along on pitch, you know. They and so it's, no one gets up and takes them out. It sounds good, you know. Yeah. So you just let them cry, and people if you want to get up and go out, you can. There's no because the service lasts all day. You have to get up and go out sometime, and but. People coming in late will come in, and they'll shake hands all around the room. Women will embrace each other, and they go up to the pulpit. The preacher is right in the middle of a sermon. He leans over and shakes hands and sort of works them into a sermon, and don't miss a beat, you know. They so that's a really, it was a very, I love to go to the church, and I was about the only child that really liked it because something in the singing spoke to me. I liked it. And even though it made me feel like crying sometimes, after a while I started singing along, and that's how you learn. You know, you learned in your mother's arms, really wailing along there. And so anytime you want to try to sing along with that kind of singing, you won't make any mistakes. It's like playing the dulcimer. Everything is easy. it all harmonizes. What else?
When did you start playing that dulcimer?
When I was very little, little child. My father had a dulcimer by the time I came along. I guess they got the first dulcimer when Edna was a baby, or Edna and Jewel, maybe when the twins were babies, Jewel and them. And the older ones didn't hear any instruments, but then the dulcimer came in about that time, and then later on, someone came along playing the fiddle, and her dad had heard the fiddle when he was a little child, and he made him a gourd fiddle. But they didn't have real fiddles around there until after the dulcimer, and then the banjo.
A gourd fiddle? I've seen gourd banjos, but this. Oh.
Well,
I've never seen a gourd.
You make a gourd anything.
I guess you could.
Dad, he got some hairs out of the horse's tail and made a bowl, and played his gourd fiddle, because he'd seen how it was done. You know, you put it in the crook of your arm and you play it like that. And he played Shady Grove and all kinds of things then. But yeah.
Sounds as if you said when the dulcimer came in.
Well, I don't remember. It was, but it was Ed Thomas in Hindman, Kentucky, or in Knott County, where Dad was born and raised, was the first one that we know of that made dulcimers. And he was born back in the 1850s sometime. So it was about 1870. He started making them as a young man, and nobody knows where he learned. So he started making them about 1870, and then people started buying them from him for $4 or $5 or a night's lodging or something like that. And he wandered around and sold them to people and traded them for people.
Was
to
that
be.
County, you were in southeast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that
farther north? Knott is right next to Perry, so they're both in the southeast. It's side by side, sort of. No, I don't know where he. Nobody that's left in his family, and Dad himself, who got the dulcimer from him, don't know where he learned to make them. And I haven't the vaguest idea where he learned. He must have learned from somebody. Virginia has an old dulcimer tradition, and West Virginia, I don't know. I think West Virginia and Virginia probably have about the same source. Yeah, there were some old ones that I've seen too that are a lot older than that, but our Ed Thomas
must have seen those. Mm-hmm. We don't know where they came from, really. Pennsylvania Dutch country or Scandinavian, or it's not English, Scottish, or Irish. So it's the European countries that it comes from.
When did you start writing your own songs?
When situations came along that didn't have any old songs to cover them, to speak for them, I sometimes had to make up things. I guess the first song I did was a children's song, was a Bluebird song with my sons. Mm. And most of my written songs sound like old songs because I love the old tunes and the old song forms, and I kind of fit a new thought into the old tunes sometimes. Sometimes I make up my own tune, but a lot of times I just use the older song forms. I borrow from them. I don't ever put a song exactly to an old song, but I'll take the song and change it just enough, the tune, and change it just enough to accommodate my song. And let's see if I can think of an example of that. Well, this is not very... here's one I did. I did some collecting in Ireland and Scotland and England back in the early 1952. Is when I was there, before the revival, before all the bands and before all the fast music. There were just people like me and my mother and so on sitting around in kitchens and singing the old songs. And if there was a band, it was a Cayley band that was kind of rumpty-tump, you know, they just got them together, a banjo and a bagpipe and a this and a that, and they'd go to and play for dances. And that was the band music. I collected a real pretty song in Ireland, in County Armagh, from a real beautiful singer. But when I got home, the tune kept going through my head, and finally I did West Virginia Mine Disaster from that tune.
Oh.
And so I'll do a verse or two of West Virginia for you, a coal mine disaster song. And then I'll sing the other song I learned it from, I based it on.
I'd love to hear you do it all.
That's such a favorite of mine. Say, did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed all these houses on his way to the coal. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining West Virginia. His home. It was just before 12 I was feeding the children. Ben Mosley came running to bring us the news. Number 8 is all flooded, many men are in danger. And we don't know their number, but we fear they're all doomed. So I picked up the baby and I left all the others to comfort each other and pray for our own. There's Timmy, 14, and there's John, not much younger. Their own time soon will be coming to go down the black hole. Oh, if I had the money to do more than just feed them, I'd give them good learning, the best could be found. So when they grow up, they'd be checkers and weighers, not spend their time drilling in the dark underground. Now, what can I say to his poor little children? Or what can I tell his old mother at home? Or what can I say to my heart that's clear broken? To my heart that's clear broken if my darling is gone. Say, did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed all your houses on his way to the coal. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining West Virginia, his home. Sean, what was his last name? Shauna Boyle, yes, in County Armagh, sang this one for me, and he said this was from his father, and he called him his dad. This is from my dad. And he sings, he croons. He asked, what do you mean? He croons the songs, and he says, well, he sits in front of the fire, and he puts his hand like this, and he just sings for himself. He doesn't care whether anyone's listening or not. He just croons it to himself. So this was the way he sang it to me. I'll try to sing it a little bit like he did. Did you see my dearest with eyes of the clearest? His cheeks like the blood that's new dropped on snow. He was tall, dark, and slender, and his eyes warm and tender. It'll be my greenwood land till time is no more. Isn't that
goodness.
Pretty song.
Oh, that's pretty.
It's a crooning.
That's crooning. My goodness. I don't know if you feel like doing that for them or not, but one of my favorite songs that you wrote, and especially after knowing the occasion and how you wrote it, is Still I Love Him.
Okay, I usually do auto harp with that, but I can sing it without it, probably.
especially if they know how you came to write that.
I don't think I had a bass. Maybe you can recognize. Sometimes people write think they write tunes, and then it turns out that they've borrowed it from somewhere. I can't think of any that really Still I Love Him is really the phrase Still I Love Him comes from an Irish song. Ah, but still I love him, I'll forget him, no, I'll forgive him, I'll be with him tomorrow, bye and bye, you know, or I'll be with him wherever he goes. Margaret Berry used to sing that. But this, I just took the phrase "Still I Love Him" and did my own song about it, and it was a anniversary song for my folks. Mom and Dad were married. This was their 60th, and he had got forgetful, you know, in his hardening of the arteries, or I don't think it was maybe Alzheimer's. I don't know, but he was old. He was 87 or so, and he's not so old anymore. But still, he was that way, and got forgetting everybody, and forgot his children, and then he didn't know Mama, and this was a one day he came around through the house, and she came around through the house, and she's always a fussing, and she's saying, why doesn't he come back to himself just for 15 minutes? I'd like to tell him a few things. And we kind of laughed at her and said, Mama, didn't you get it all said in 60 years? And she said, no, you never do get it all said. And so this has happened to him. They've come around and they banged into each other like that. And he just grabbed her by the shoulders and says, where have you been? I've been looking for you everywhere. So for about 15 minutes, they stood and talked. And this is what the song's about. I don't know how it'll sound without accompaniment. I've never done it. Who's this young man with bright hair shining, laughing, teasing, my heart binding? Folks all love him, so young and funny, they all know him, he's my Johnny. Still I love him, still I love him, though he knows it, still I tell him. Every morning, again that evening, night and nooning, still I love him. Dishes a-washing and clothes a-drying, children hungry, children crying. He keeps a-working and I keep slaving, life's all hunger, life's all craving. Still I love him, still I love him, though he knows it, still I tell him. Every morning, again that evening, night and nooning, still I love him. Who's this old one with gray hair shining, years of living, kind face lining? Neighbors whisper he's old and funny, don't they know him, he's my Johnny. Still I love him, still I love him, though he knows it, still I tell him. Every morning, again at evening, night and nooning, still I love him. No, nothing. I just going to ask you something and I forgot.
Yeah.
Can you tell us
a little bit about your father, when he did well, good,
and why you were growing up? My dad was always a farmer. He always made a crop. You know, we raised corn, and that was our bread and the food for the animals. We had one horse or mule, and one cow with a calf or two, and a few pigs and a few chickens. Not it just a farm to get by on. You know, it was not to sell anything from. Hillside farm. He had to clear it out, clear out the new ground, and roll down the logs and make a place to plant the corn. So that was the kind of farmer he was, and he had did a few odd jobs to make money all of his life. He'd try different things. The very first thing he did after he was married to make money was to send off and get a talking machine that no one around home had ever seen one, a Victrola. You know, you wind it up and it had a horn, and so he would take it around to elections and things like that and play those little cylinders, Whistling Rufus and a few other tunes he'd play for the people, and they'd come up and throw pennies down the horn. So he had the first jukebox, sort of. And then he sent off and got a kit to be an optometrist. He got little glasses, you know, and lenses and things, and a little thing you measure. You look through it like this, and you put the dots further and closer. And he measured people's eyes and prescribed glasses for them. And he used to get letters addressed to Dr. Ritchie, and we were all so proud of him. Just things like that, different things to make a living. It's all in my book. That story particularly, because it made such an impression on me when they were telling me about all the things that Dad had done. And someone piped up and said, well, he made a little moonshine one time too. And Mama said, now you shut up. You hush about them times. She didn't want that brought out, and she didn't want the children to know about that. Well, he did make homebrew, kind of a beer, you know. And we used, I remember putting it up in the loft, where we got a little hole about this big, and the old grown-ups couldn't crawl through, so they'd always make me crawl in and out and get the homebrew. When Uncle Isaac would come, or somebody Dad would wanted to give a bottle to, he'd make me go up and get it for him. I tasted it one time, and it was the worst stuff in the world. And cured me from ever wanting any homebrew. Yes.
Did you become aware of the outside, one part of the question or the other?
When did you recognize
who you were in terms of honor recognition?
My sisters went to Berea, you know, into Berea College, and they were older. But as far back as I can remember, some of the older girls had been coming home from school, you know, and bringing stories and tales about the outside. So they were the ones that didn't know about the outside until they went out. But I, being home and hearing their stories, was aware pretty much when I was young about it. We were there I hadn't been to any of those places, but I heard stories about them and everything. So, first time I ever went out, I guess anywhere, I went after high school, I went to a couple of folk festivals, Sarah Gertrude Knott's Folk Festival when I was about 14 or so. I think it was in Cincinnati or someplace, and that's as far away from home as I'd been. And then when I was, after high school, I went to college at Williamsburg, and that was my next, well, before that I spent a year in Boston with my sister Una and lived with her for a while. So that was my big being away from home, and I got so homesick. I liked Boston, but I got terribly homesick. I remember that was I half liked it and half hated it. But I was 17 then, and then when I came back home, I went to college, started going to college. I was trying to get out of going to college is what I was trying to do. I thought maybe I'd meet somebody and get married, which is what you're supposed to do around. But Dad was against that. He was the first one to send his girls to college, because most girls around there just got to be 16 and got married, or you know, went part of the way to high school or went through the eighth grade and got married. And he was always one for education, and it was harder for him to do without the boys than it was the girls. Luckily he had four girls before he had any boys, and so the girls started going off to school and got scholarships, and two of them went to Wellesley College, and they were smart, I guess. And then Raymond, I remember finding a letter to my brother Raymond from Dad when he went to Pine Mountain to go to high school. And it said, now, son, you work hard and do your best and make good grades, because you know your mother and I are having to do without your work. You know, they didn't give him any money to go on. They worked their way through, but it was a sacrifice to do without your sons, because they were the ones who worked in the fields and who did the hard work around the house. So when the sons were gone, the parents and the girls had to pitch in and do their work. So that was the way we...
Did your mother and father, well, obviously your father could write, you know, had school?
He was educated. He went through the eighth grade under somebody called Fessor Clark, and everybody seems to still remember around Hindman. And then he went to, just after he was married, he wanted to do something besides just dig on the hillside. So that's another thing he did to make money. He put a trunk on his back. They got some kind of train or conveyance as far as, Cincinnati, I guess. And then they walked, two of them went together, out to someplace in Ohio to study in what they called a normal school. And so he graduated from normal school. I think it was 2 years, a two-year course. And then he came back and had his teaching certificate, and he taught school for a while. So he was a school teacher. He was an educated man for those parts. he had had the equivalent of high school and 2 years of, well, I mean, eighth grade and then 2 years of high school is what it really amounted mm-hmm. to. And he came back and taught in the community for a long time, mm-hmm. for a few years, really.
Mm-hmm. Was your mother educated at all?
No, she went to the fourth grade. Mm-hmm. But she had a lot of education as the years went by. People coming in and telling her things, and you never could tell that she wasn't educated. She could write very well, and she could read. She learned a lot in her mm-hmm. In her years of school.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Yes. For any of my brothers and sisters? No, I wrote a book about them and told a lot. The book is a story of our growing up, and it's got about 42 songs. It started out to be a songbook. I had just gone to New York and was doing social work up there. I was bringing culture to the New Yorkers. I like to say that around New Yorkers anyway. But I was teaching songs and games in a Henry Street settlement, and we'll see. People started asking me to play and sing, and I had a dulcimer with me, and they started asking me to come to parties and come to my school and come to this and that, and I finally started giving little programs and things, and I met Alan Lomax, who found out what a big family repertory I had, and he wanted me to put all my songs together for the Library of Congress. And then he said, well, you should do better than that. You should get a book published of your own family songs. And so I started writing down the songs. And he said, do a sampling of about 12 songs. So I put down the different songs, the main ones I wanted to get published. And then he said, write a little bit. I said, I'll write about, because they were different versions than the songs people were used to, so I thought they needed a little explaining. So I started writing down a little story about each song, about who sung it and where it came from and what it meant to us and all that. And the Bad Time story is in there about Great Jehovah. And so finally I got that all written out and sent it, and we took it around to different publishers. And one by one they turned it down because it looked like it was going to be 300 songs. And they said that was too expensive for an unknown person to have printed. You know, they'd be taking music reproduction was very expensive in those days, and still is, I guess. But finally, I got to Oxford University Press, and one of the editors there said, "I like your stories. I like what you wrote about. Your introductions are great." He said, "Expand your introductions and make a written book, and you can put in a few songs if you want to." So I started expanding the introductions, and I started remembering more and more, and I started meeting more people, and people started remembering things for me, and it got fascinating. And I got the little book done, and I had sneaked in 42 songs. And they said, "This is too many songs." And I said, "Well, I don't see how we can cut any of them out." And he said, "Well, leave it to me. I'll cut them out." So And about a week later, he came back and said, "I can't cut any of them out." So it's called Singing Family of the Cumberlands, and it's been in print ever since 1952, and in schools and colleges. And
that's Oxford University?
Yeah, and another thing I did, I put in the way people talked, my granny and my dad, the dialect, you know, and I just spelled it the way they said it. And I took out all the apostrophes and everything, and I just wrote it down the way they said it. And that was kind of revolutionary then. Hardly anybody had done that. And so my editor said, "You can't do this." And when I'd say a word that he didn't understand, he was from New England. He'd try to get me to substitute a New England word for it so that people would know what it meant. And I said, "No, I'm from Kentucky, and this is the way what we said it." And he said, "Well, I'm going to England and on my vacation, and when I come back, we'll make a decision." But he was almost about to throw the book out because of the dialect thing.
And I said, this is the way my granny spoke. I want it just written just like, I don't know where I got the courage to do things like that in those days. I never would do it now, I'm sure. I've learned too much, but I was just ignorant in those days. So I'd just say, you can't do that. This is the way my granny spoke, you know. And this little old girl, you know, in her 20s, arguing with Oxford University Press. Well, he went to England and came back and said, you're right. We'll leave the dialect the way it is. So that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the old words like foch and he foch it and she, and all the, well, you know, it's that there weren't too many of those old words that people used by the time I came along, but you'd be surprised how people still think that people speak like that, because even now, sometimes in New York, someone will come up to me and say, speak Elizabethan for me.
I very much recommend that Jean's book. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And many of her albums, I'm real attached to Sweet Rivers.
Mm.
That's just one of my favorites. If you ever get a chance to get a hold of her album, Sweet Rivers. Anyway, Jean's going to be back at 1 o'clock. And so I know all of us.
That's in the science building.
Uh-huh, yeah. In the science building. That we want to hear her sing more and maybe if she's got any energy left to tell us any more about her music and her life. And we thank you very much for coming in with us.